From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the celebratory sound of the Polyphonic Spree. We meet the group's founder and frontman, Tim DeLauder. You may have heard the 24-member ensemble without knowing it. They're the soundtrack for a Volkswagen commercial. Also, two nursing home codgers take on evil. One of them is Elvis Presley, and the other thinks he's JFK. In the new film, Bubba Hotep, we'll meet the director and screenwriter, Don Coscarelli. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Chain Gang of Love, the new album by the Raveonettes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. California Governor Gray Davis says he's pleased with a federal appeals court decision to allow the vote on his recall to take place on October 7th.
I think we have the momentum. I think we should strike while the iron is hot. I think people are deciding as the date narrows, as the date is around the corner, that this is not good for California. It's not good for our future. And I'd rather have the election now.
The American Civil Liberties Union had argued that the vote should be postponed until March so that six counties would have time to replace error-prone punch card voting machines. ACLU lawyer Mark Rosenbaum said his organization has decided not to appeal the issue any further.
I think we felt, as institutions and our clients felt as well, that the responsible act at this time would be to say to all Californians, let's turn to the issues in this election and hope that the margin of victory here is not exceeded by the margin of error in these machines.
Mike Leavitt, the Republican governor of Utah, went before a Senate panel today as President Bush's nominee to head the Environmental Protection Agency. NPR's David Wellner reports.
Governor Leavitt got a friendly bipartisan reception at his confirmation hearing, but Nevada Democrat Harry Reid said he warned Leavitt about filling the post Christy Whitman left last summer.
And I said to him, why in the world would you want this job? I said, I will do anything that I can to help you personally, but I think the record of this administration environmentally is awful.
Leavitt insisted both he and President Bush want a cleaner environment, and he promised EPA's rules will be obeyed.
The goal is compliance. To find ways to move people to compliance. And there are times when strong enforcement is the only tool available to have that happen.
Leavitt endorsed the president's Clear Skies initiative, which caps some power plant emissions, but not carbon dioxide. Three Democratic senators vowed they'll block his nomination in the full Senate. David Wallner, NPR News, the Capitol.
NASA Administrator Sean O'Keefe has accepted the resignations of all members of a safety advisory panel that was criticized after the Columbia space shuttle disaster. NPR's Joe Palca reports.
Congress established the Aerospace Safety Advisory Panel in 1967 after a fire that took the lives of three Apollo astronauts. The panel was supposed to act as an independent body advising on the safety of NASA operations, facilities, and personnel. But following the Columbia accident, critics have questioned whether the panel was fulfilling that role. Some have said the panel should have done a better job of identifying the shuttle safety problems, others that NASA should have done a better job of listening to the panel's advice. In her resignation letter, current panel chair Shirley McCarty said the resignations would allow NASA and Congress the freedom to revitalize the panel. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks, the Dow gained 40 points today to close at 9,576. The NASDAQ was up 27 points to close at 1901. This is NPR News. Hurricane recovery efforts have barely begun on parts of North Carolina's Outer Banks Islands. NPR's Adam Hochberg says people on Hatteras Island are having trouble getting basic supplies after their only highway was destroyed by Hurricane Isabel last week.
They are bringing over by boat and helicopter food and water. They're trying to reestablish the water lines. There's an issue of sewage, sanitation services. Those are the most basic things that people need. Fuel for vehicles. We were shuttled over here by the Coast Guard on a boat, and we're trying to get back, but it's going to be a struggle to do it because they're running low on fuel until they can get their next shipment in. So the biggest thing at the moment is just trying to meet some of the basic needs before they can even think about bringing in demolition crews and architects and builders to start working on the buildings.
NPR's Adam Hochberg reporting from Hatteras Island, North Carolina. The state's governor says the highway connecting to the island will be rebuilt by the end of next month. Four people pleaded not guilty today in the Chicago nightclub stampede that left 21 people dead last February. Two owners of the E2 nightclub, the manager and promoter of the club, all said they were innocent of manslaughter charges in the panic, which began when a club security guard used pepper spray to break up a fight on a dance floor crowded with around 1,000 people. Clubgoers rushed to the exit down a narrow staircase, and people at the bottom were crushed. Prosecutors said the club owners and management had been ordered to shut down because they didn't have proper permits and had failed to mark alternative exits well enough. In stocks, the S&P 500 gained 6 to close at 1,029. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, embracing the diversity of more than 100,000 employees across America and the people they serve. SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. In an age of music sampling and virtually limitless digital effects, the Dallas-based band The Polyphonic Spree is an anachronism. 24 musicians on stage, playing an array of instruments, including flute, French horn, theremin, and harp, along with guitars, bass, and drums. There's a 9-person choir, and everyone wears flowing white robes. The mix of rock and symphonic music with the visual image of a rousing tent revival meeting has some critics scrambling for ways to pigeonhole the group. One came up with this: they're like the Hare Krishna Jackson 25. Tim DeLauder is the founder and frontman of the Polyphonic Spree. He was a member of the 90s rock band Tripping Daisy. Now DeLauder is taking this unwieldy show on a national tour, and they have an album, The Beginning Stages of the Polyphonic Spree. Here's a cut called It's the Sun. Welcome to Fresh Air.
I'm very, very happy to be here. Thank you very much.
Well, let me ask you this. What came first for you when you were conceiving of this band? Did you hear the sound, or did you see this gestalt of a whole choral group dressed in white on the stage?
No, my version is very not as romantic as it seems now. Mine was a lot more linear and unromantic. It was going for a sound that was something that I had been hearing for a long time. I was really inspired as a kid to orchestral pop music, sunny pop music, in the early 70s. Bands that were using symphonic orchestration to be able to do their songs and tell their stories.
And, like what? Like the Association? Or?
Well, the Association and Fifth Dimension and bands like that, Phil Spector's sound, Beach Boys, Walt Disney storybook records. These things.
Like, yeah, they're all combo.
Well, they're it's kind of the same music. It's really weird. I don't know. As a kid, it was real. I don't know. It's the first thing I ever really bought was that kind of music. First record I ever bought was Beach Baby by the First Class, and it's just this real sunny, up pop, but symphonic orchestration helped to tell the story. It's just, I don't know. And as a kid, I don't know, just really appealed to me. And so, going through my years of becoming a songwriter, I fleshed out guitar, bass, and drums for a long time in my previous band, Tripping Daisy. And then it became like a wishful thinking when I was recording, like, wow, I wish I had a flute at this part instead of this guitar line, or at this crescendo I wish I had this glissando of a harp playing here. And it was that kind of like wishful thinking back then that I thought, well, you know, one day I'm going to put a band together that's going to have this sound that is appealing for me. It was very self-indulgent putting Polyphonic Spree together, and it's definitely has evolved into something a lot more beautiful than what I had ever anticipated.
You know, there's this very trippy sound to hearing so many voices. It's almost as if, you know, when you sing into a fan and you get you get that effect.
Yeah, that's funny you brought that up, because that was another inspiration of mine, was the fan. As a kid, I would sing in those fans and do melodies in there, and you could really glide, like, meow! You could really kind of glide the rail of the melody through a fan. And to kind of regenerate that effect, I initially started using effects on my voice in early bands in high school and stuff, because I wanted that kind of effect. And then it got to the point where I would double my vocal, and then sometimes triple and quadruple and add more vocals. And it was, little did I know, I was grooming myself to be able to have a choir. And then it got to the point where I'd like to have 10 people singing, you know, as one, instead of just me and doubling myself. And it all came from that fan that we've all kind of sang in or talked into at one time. It also made a major impression on me.
Well, did you sing in chorus as a kid? And I've got to say, it does remind me of my chorus experience, where we all sang that Coke commercial song.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
Oh, like to I teach sang, the world to sing.
Of course. I mean, I sang right there with you in the living room. I wasn't with a choir. Never was in choir or sang in school or anything. I did try band, like concert band, and I was played drums, but I pretty much had my own agenda. I started my first band in the third grade, and I was playing drums, and they were actually ice cream buckets I had gotten from Baskin Robbins. I bolted them together to make myself a kit, because I wasn't able to get one from the parents. They weren't embracing the loud, bombastic drum sound yet. So that's where it started, and then vocals came later. I never was in choir, but I, you know, as a kid, I also went to down here in Texas. We used to have these big, like, church revivals, and I think it was the Beverly Hills Baptist Church that used to have them at this Bronco Bowl that we had here in Dallas. And massive kind of big choir, big band, and it was church, but everyone's, you know, singing. It's all about the music, and I'm sure that had an effect as well.
Well, the lyrics are really upbeat in your song. It's all inspirational. It's about hope or recovery. And I'm wondering what was going on in your life when you did start the band, because I know your first band dismantled after the drug overdose of your bandmate, Wes Berggren. So did his death hit you hard, and did that experience somehow contribute, help shape the kind of music that you were hearing in your head?
I definitely, at the time, you don't really, I don't know, I didn't really think about it. I guess I was so in it that I didn't really realize the after effect. But yeah, most definitely, I can look back and totally see. That's it's still something that we're all dealing with Wes being gone. And at that particular time, I was also a father for the first time. My daughter Stella was being born, and it was kind of weird. I was going through the loss of a dear friend, and then the birth of my child, my first child. And so it was a very strange time for me, and a vulnerable time. And lyrically, I think I've always kind of been on the upside, so to speak. I kind of have a blueprint past of having a kind of a positive, this hopeful aspect on things. And the way I look at it, it's my path, and you better be optimistic if you're going down your own path. So that's the way I tend to look at things.
So you had this idea for this this polyphonic chorus, and I understand your friend booked you a gig even before you had any band members. So how long did you have to get the group together?
Roughly 2 weeks. It was, Well, I'd gotten to the point where once I had named the band, that was the biggest hurdle for me at the beginning was once I decided to do it and go for it, I really couldn't go forth until I had named the sound of what this thing was going to be called. Because at the beginning, that's all I really cared about was the sound. I thought, I can't do it. It won't happen unless I can. It has to be named for me. For some reason, that was a big point. And once I came up with the name, I was like, that's it. And I just started talking about it. And,
well, where did that come from? Where did the name come from?
The name. Oh, this is kind of funny. I collected these stickers called Wacky Packages. I'm sure a lot of kids out
the
there.
The bane of my youth.
That's like, exactly.
That's like the 70s equivalent of Garbage Pail Kids, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. This was what I used to blow my lunch money on every morning before school. And so I have every single one of them that they ever made. And
just for people who don't remember what these are, you must know some examples that if you're a collector.
There were these wonderful stickers that came out that mocked consumer products. Instead of Tide detergent, it was Toad detergent. And it looked just like the product, but it was spelled into the joke of what they decided to name that one as. And wonderful artwork on there. And anyway, it came with two stickers and a bubble gum and a card. And they were 5 cents, and I loved them, and so we traded them all the time. Anyway, I've got an uncut sheet of these things, and
collector's item. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I actually have two of them, but this particular one, I just had it framed, and it was kind of leaning against the wall in the bedroom, and I'm trying to think of the name, and I hadn't come up with anything yet, nothing, not even a working title or anything for the name of the band. But I thought I'm trying to think, and I'm standing in the bedroom, and it's kind of dark in there. The only light that's coming in there is from in there in the, kitchen spilling in there. And it's kind of like gracing this picture I just had framed. And I just kind of casually glanced it, and I caught the word poly. And it was off one of the stickers for polydent denture adhesive. And it had a parrot on there for Polly Want a Cracker or something like that. And I just saw the word Polly, and I said the polyphonic spree. And I thought for a second, oh my gosh, man, the polyphonic spree. Oh my goodness. And my wife is in there on the computer, and she goes, what'd you say? And I said, the polyphonic spree. And she goes, she's quiet. She goes, I like it. And I go, this is it. Oh, my gosh. I started running around the room screaming, oh, got it, man. It just hit me. It was so warm, and just that was it. And then she was online. She types up domain name to see if she can get it, and we bought it immediately. And that was it. It was the polyphonic spree. And from that moment on, I had everything in my head and knew exactly what I wanted to do. And so got to the point where I was driving my good friend Chris Penn crazy, and my wife, and he said, well, I'm going to book you on a show opening for Granddaddy and Bright Eyes at the Gypsy Tea Room here in Dallas. And I said, I don't know about this. And
those are big bands.
Yeah, well, I go, I don't even have a band. I don't have a band. I don't have these songs together, and that's in 2 weeks, And he goes, you can do it. So that's when we did it, and I went to some close friends and some acquaintances, and I was able to, gather up 13 people, and we did the show.
Where did you find these musicians, and are they classically trained? They seem to be. Are they the kind of classical musicians who are always looking for a way to do something cool and less restrained and less controlled, to rock out?
Yeah, you know what? See, I came from a rock world, and I did not, kind of a rock experimental world, and I just didn't know any of these people that I was seeking, these instruments I was seeking, and I just literally came by them from word of mouth, from my family and friends putting the word out there, and these random people calling, and a lot of them were younger people that were in school, in college playing their instrument, or in high school they played their instrument. A lot of them are classically trained musicians, but it's from college and from high school. None of them were in working orchestras, except for one of them that did it every now and then in El Paso. That's the harp player.
I'm talking with Tim DeLauder. He's the founder and lead singer of the band The Polyphonic Spree. They have a CD out on Hollywood Records, and they're just starting out on a national tour. Tim, let's take a break now, and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Tim DeLauder. He's the frontman and founder of the band The Polyphonic Spree. You might recognize their song Light and Day, which is currently featured in a Volkswagen ad. That's Light and Day, The Polyphonic Spree, led by my guest, Tim DeLauder, founder and lead singer in the band. I want to talk about your stage presence, what a concert is like. First of all, everyone's in these long white robes. You have about, 22 members in the band right now?
There's 24 of us now.
You're all on stage, and there's an incredible amount of movement going on. The singers, there's kind of a church choir swaying and dancing thing going on of about 9 or 10 people, and then people playing instruments or dancing all over the place, and you at times are conducting, you're also singing, and you're lifting your arms up to the sky like a messianic leader. How did this performance style evolve, and what did you say to the people in the band about how they should act on stage?
You know, I didn't say anything, and that's the beautiful part that came out of this. Something happened. This wonderful energy has evolved with this group that I don't know, that's extremely contagious for all of us. And once it gets going, it's pretty an amazing event to be a part of.
Well, the thing about the repetition in the music and the chorus and the uplifting nature of it and the white robes. It has such a religious or spiritual impression. In fact, the effect of the band evokes a lot of associations for me. There's that evangelical tent thing going on, and also it makes me think of Up With People, that patriotic group. And
and
a lot of people have pointed out, it feels a little bit like a cultish feeling, reminiscent of Waco or some kind of white-robed cult. I can't help but wonder if you're playing off of those associations in some way.
You know, it's I never really thought about how I, you know, when I was telling you, I was thinking of a beautiful image, and I'm thinking of the music. In my mind, I'm putting out this beautiful music, wonderful music, with these people wearing white robes. It's flowing, and it fits the theme of what we're playing. I didn't realize how it might look to other people until press started, you know, talking about it and sensationalizing sometimes, and being cynical about the way that we looked in the music. It kind of fit this puzzle for them to say this kind of cultish thing. What's up with these happy singing people wearing white robes from Texas? And I never really thought about that until they brought it up. And I know that sounds kind of weird, I guess because I was just so in it and thinking about it on a, I don't know, I mean, more of a, the level of what I thought about the music, more of a beautiful aspect, more so than how it looked in a kind of cynical way. And I don't know, it just didn't, it didn't cross my mind. And then it did, and I was going, wow, I guess I can see how they could see that. And then I started to think, well, was this subconsciously? And then I'm going, why did I pick this? I mean, why do I want robes? Why am I singing like this? And then you kind of just go, you start, you know, just trying to think about your past and your life, and you try to, it's almost like therapy. Even when you do interviews, you get questions asked, and you go, well, I want to give them right answer here. And sorry. Before you know it, you're going, what is going on here? But it, you know, my grandfather was a preacher and a very charismatic man, and my aunt would thank me right now. She got mad at me for not mentioning that one time. She called me up, and she goes, why didn't you mention your grandfather? Don't you remember him practicing his sermon right in front of you and singing and bending his ear over and, you know, and you being in church and watching him up there, you know, preaching to the church? And I'm like, you know. And that I was mesmerized by that. And then also going to the churches here that used to have the music and the choir and everything, it definitely made an impact on me. And I never really thought about it until people started asking me questions, and I had to really start thinking about it, because I was just reacting, you know. I wasn't really going, well, because I was affected by this, I'm going to do this. It's really weird. It's it took other people to kind of go, well, did you know that you're like this? And did you know where this came from? I'm going, well, thanks a lot. This was a lot more than just an interview. I know a lot more about myself. Thanks a lot. So it's I think it has a combination of a lot of different things, and who knows why we do it. But there's definitely paths and different landmarks along your way that you can definitely point at and go, well, that can, I can see that being a big reason why. But I don't know. Strange world.
Well, Tim DeLauder, I really enjoyed talking with you. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Tim DeLauder, founder of the Polyphonic Spree. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air. Have a day. Celebrate. Soon you'll find the answer. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Stones of Summer, the novel that inspired the film Stone Reader, available October 22nd at Barnes & Noble stores and online at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Vintage Books, paperback publishers of the new novel Caramello by Sandra Cisneros, author of The House on Mango Street, and from Nonesuch Records, now featuring the new album Stumble Into Grace by Emmylou Harris, available at all Barnes & Noble music locations. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, Elvis does battle with a mummy. We talk with director Don Coscarelli about his new film, Bubba Hotep, starring Bruce Campbell as Elvis and Ossie Davis as a nursing home resident who thinks he's JFK. Coscarelli also wrote and directed Phantasm and The Beastmaster. And Ken Tucker reviews the new album by the Danish musicians, The Ravenettes. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave.
Well, 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 if it isn't my favorite patient, how are you this morning, Mr. Hare?
I'm all right. But I prefer Mr. Presley or Elvis. I keep telling you that. I don't go by Sebastian Half anymore, okay? I don't try and hide anymore.
Well, of course, I knew that. I forgot. Good morning, Elvis.
It's a truism in Hollywood that you should be able to sum up the plot of any movie on a cocktail napkin. So here's the pitch for the new film Bubba Hotep. Nursing home residents Elvis and John F. Kennedy battle evil Egyptian mummy. Filmmaker Don Coscarelli couldn't resist this premise. He is the creator of the horror fantasy movies The Beastmaster and the four-part Phantasm series. While his new film features the guts and gore you'd expect from the genre and stars Bruce Campbell of Army of Darkness fame, it's a surprisingly gentle hybrid of comedy, drama, and shock. Campbell plays a decrepit Elvis living in a nursing home. Everyone thinks he's an Elvis impersonator. His wheelchair-bound best friend, played by Ossie Davis, believes he is JFK. They team up to fight fantastic creatures risen from the dead. Bubba Hotep is based on a short story by mystery writer Joe Lansdale. I asked Don Coscarelli what the attraction was.
I had come across a book that was called The Drive-In, about these kids who get trapped in a drive-in when a meteor hits it, and they're all, it was kind of a very strange comic thing. And that one had already been optioned. There are a lot of interesting directors have circled Joe's work for a long time. I know David Lynch had one of his books under option, and Catherine Bigelow had another, but none of them, for one reason or another, got made into a film. We couldn't get that one funded, but a few years later, I got a copy of his new short story collection, and in the dust jacket was this description, Elvis Battles Mummy. And it just jumped out at me.
That's all you needed to know,
yeah,
right?
That was it.
Well, in this film, Elvis is in a nursing home, and he's ailing. He has quite a few medical problems, but I guess the most salient one is a nasty urological condition, which plays its part in the movie. But he goes by the name of Sebastian Half, who was an Elvis impersonator, and the idea is that Elvis allegedly traded lives with Sebastian Half when Elvis got older and disillusioned. Is this all straight out of the short story?
Oh, yeah. I was very faithful to the book because all the ingredients were there when I read the short story. And what appealed to me was this concept. It's almost like out of the Prince and the Pauper or Trading Places, about how, you know, the king could want to get off the merry-go-round and go back to a normal life. And it's just a bit of the backstory, but I found it quite compelling, the idea that he would find this great Elvis impersonator and switch places with him, and then for one reason or another not be able to switch back and make a living traveling the Southwest playing himself as an Elvis impersonator. That I thought was great.
Well, somehow, against all odds, since this film does involve an evil undead mummy, the film has a very sweet side, really. I mean, there's something very touching about this depiction of an aging Elvis as you really develop it early in the film. And there's also a poignant relationship that Elvis develops with a fellow resident in his nursing home, Jack. And Jack believes he's JFK, even though he's black. Let's listen to this clip. Here's Jack, played by Ossie Davis, and he's waking up Sebastian Half, or Elvis, played by Bruce Campbell, to express his support and get Elvis to join him in the battle against the forces of evil.
Listen, I know you're Elvis. There was a rumor, you know, that you hated me. But I thought about that. You hated me, you could have finished me off the other night. All I want from you is that you look me straight in the eye and assure me you had nothing at all to do with that day in Dallas, and that you did not know Lee Harvey Oswald or Jack Ruby.
Now look, man, I had nothing to do with Dallas. And I knew neither Lee Harvey Oswald nor Jack Ruby.
Good. May I call you Elvis instead of Sebastian?
You may.
Excellent.
A scene from the new film Bubba Hotep by my guest filmmaker Don Coscarelli. Now, this is something of a miracle that you could pull off a touching scene in a mock horror genre film involving a mummy and a huge flying scarab beetle monster. Were you going for poignancy?
Well, yeah, because at its core, I see this film as a redemptive Elvis picture. I mean, if you look at the way that the king went out, I mean, according to legend, or according to the news, he was, quote, straining at stool. I mean, that just was not a way for Elvis the king to go out. And in reading Joe's story, it really provided a way that I think the fans could accept the redemption and death of Elvis. And that's what really sparked me, was the fact that, you know, if Elvis really still was alive, he would have a lot of regrets. There would be a lot of things that he would be ruminating about and would be trying to fix in his own way. And that's really what attracted me to the story.
This wheelchair-bound JFK figure, Jack, and Elvis battle against lost mummy creatures and other artifacts. And these artifacts were part of a traveling Egyptian museum roadshow, and they were lost in a nearby lake in the 60s when the bus crashed that was carrying all this stuff. You're going to have to describe what the mummy looks like now.
Well, he dresses in cowboy boots and old ratty jeans and a big broad cowboy hat, this mummy. And the backstory is that he stole those clothes off of the driver of that bus that plunged into the lake, and that's why he dresses that way. Unfortunately, he didn't make it into the film. But he's
and you wonder why he's in a cowboy hat.
But he's a he's as Jack describes him in the film, he's like King Tut's brother, and he was. His sarcophagus was traveling from town to town, going to museums. And, he's a character we don't go into too much detail, but, you know, he's a guy, 4,000-year-old mummy, and he's, he's got some history and backstory.
And he's got some wear on him.
Yeah, definitely some wear. But he's still pretty resilient. So there is some kind of comment there, I think, about, we've got Elvis and Jack is these aging old guys in a rest home, and they're fighting somebody who's really aged and decrepit. But it makes for a good match.
There's a concert scene in the film which features Sebastian Haff, the Elvis impersonator, and we don't actually hear any Elvis singing. Why was that?
Well, this was another one of our challenges in making the film on such a low budget. We couldn't afford the rights to any of the actual Elvis songs, and we had a concert sequence where Sebastian Haff, the Elvis impersonator, as played by Elvis, is on stage. And so we were very crafty in the use of music, and we used a lot of Elvis's signature moves that he does between songs, the way he hands out the scarves to the screaming girls and the way he does his karate moves and all of that, and it came out pretty well.
I'm talking with filmmaker Don Coscarelli. His movies include the science fiction horror films Phantasm and its sequels. Also, the sword and sorcery movie The Beastmaster. He wrote and directed the new film Bubba Hotep. And it's also a hybrid comedy horror film featuring a very elderly Elvis who does battle with forces of evil from ancient Egypt. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with fantasy and horror filmmaker Don Coscarelli. His films include The Beastmaster and the Phantasm series. His new film is a comedy-slash-action horror flick featuring Elvis and an Egyptian mummy on a murder spree. It's called Bubba Hotep. Well, let's talk about Phantasm, which you made four Phantasm movies, right?
Yes.
I know that you wrote that first Phantasm movie in 3 weeks, and you were in a remote mountain cabin. Is that right?
Yeah, and this is, this was before The Evil Dead was made. So I was sort of living that kind of a thing by myself up there. It was kind of very freaky. And
this is another cult horror comedy kind of mock horror film.
Yeah, The Evil Dead, which is set in a cabin. But this was before that. And so I was in this cabin by myself, and I just used that feeling of isolation when I was writing the story, because it was a story about a boy who see some strange things that are going on, and can't really explain them. And he tries to, and he tries to enlist his brother, tries to enlist the ice cream vendor friend of theirs, and that's pretty much how I came up with that.
Well, writing it in 3 weeks all by yourself in some remote cabin, did you freak your own self out, or did you did you come up with ideas there that you?
Yeah, I remember there were things. Yeah, absolutely. I remember. Sometimes when you're writing and you can't, you're looking for inspiration any way you can. And I was drinking something out of a styrofoam cup, and I finished the drink and I poked my finger up through the cup, and I'm looking at my finger wiggling in the bottom of the cup, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. And so
that's a famous scene in the film. That's a detached finger wiggling in a box.
In a box, yes. So you find the inspiration where you can, and that's where that one came from.
You made this film with just no money. Phantasm,
yes.
by movie industry standards. So what were some of the low-tech solutions you had to come up with for the special effects? And I'm thinking of basic things like in the film often, or I'm thinking of one scene, a door flies off its hinges.
The great thing about it was that we shot the film in this pattern of shooting on weekends and then spending the 4 or 5 days during the week to prepare for the next weekend. So it gave us time. We spent a year and a half shooting the film. So we had a lot of time to work out some of the stuff. We tried to get that door to fly off the hinge. We tried a number of things. And finally, we came back to just the simplest thing possible. We put a couple handles on the back of the door, and our producer, Paul Pepperman, held onto the door, stood behind there, just threw himself forward, and then pulled the door on top of him. So you never saw Paul, but it was just a guy running with the door. Then you put a good sound effect on it, and it works.
That's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, and then of course the signature effect in the film is this chrome killer sphere. It's sort of a digital vampire, if you will. And we had to make this thing fly and appear to pursue the character down the hallway. And frankly, a lot of the effect was done with a fishing line and a fishing pole. You know, we'd put the ball on a string and fly it, and you wouldn't see the string. And then to get the long hallway shots where you'd actually see it, coming at the camera, we undercranked it into slow motion. And then we got a baseball pitcher to throw the ball from behind the camera. And then
you're kidding
reversed,
me. What, like a high school kid or something?
Yeah. And then he'd throw a fastball by camera. It would go away. And then we reversed the film, and it would fly towards you. And the interesting thing about that is that the maximum velocity was as it went by the camera. So if you reverse that, it's sort of slow at the beginning, but as it gets to the camera, it really speeds up. And it took on a very surreal, well, you've seen the movie, it works.
We actually have a clip that features, there's no dialogue, it just features this deadly flying sphere, which we should say is a homemade, it's a kind of weapon. It opens up and reveals a chainsaw.
It's like a switchblade. The different spheres do different things. There's one that impacts and holds into your head. Another one, a drill, comes out and drains your blood.
Yes. Well, that's the one I'm talking about. And this is from Phantasm 2. And we should play this because I want to talk about the sound effects that you use and how you use them. In this scene, the sphere is attacking a priest. Can you explain this, Don, before we play this, just so people can visualize it?
Well, the priest in the film is the last vestige of any kind of moral authority, and he's trying to stop the evil tall man, and he goes up to the mausoleum, and unfortunately the tall man does prevail in the sequence, and our poor father is sliced and diced.
Here we go. This is a scene featuring the deadly flying sphere from Phantasm 2. Directed and written by my guest, Don Coscarelli. Now, if you can get past the screaming in this, I think the kicker to the scene is that in the end, the priest lies presumably dead, but the sphere keeps whirring, like buzzing like the Energizer Bunny. Can you talk about how you layer the sound effects to get the effect that you're going for? I mean, here it was screaming and mechanical sounds and reverb and...
Well, there's no question that, you know, that in a fact scene like this, that sound is maybe the number one component of it. And it's something that I learned early on that we really had to focus on and spend whatever time we could to get it right. You know, that scene combines a lot of interesting things. Number one, you can hear a dentist drill in there laid over the top because everybody has a natural abhorrence of the dentist. So that sort of sets the tone when you hear that really high-end pitch when it starts to cut into the cranium. And then I think we go as low-tech as somebody sucking water through a straw as the device starts to drain the blood out of the poor victim.
Where do you get the inspiration for deadly props like the deadly sphere?
Well, that original one, it came to me in a dream. You know, a few years before I wrote this script, I didn't even have the script. I just had this notion of this chrome sphere pursuing me down a marble hallway. And it was then when I was up in the cabin working on that script, I thought, oh, yeah, that was an interesting image from the dream. I should put this in the movie. And once I put that in, then it skewed the movie in the direction of a science fiction film, which I hadn't really intended. I'll be honest, though, I don't think that any other idea in any other film I've ever made came from a dream.
Now, one of the things this Phantasm series is known for is the tall man character. And he's an evil villain creature from the dead. And he's something of an icon now. He's a tall man in funeral director clothes. He drives a hearse. He's played by the actor Angus Scrimm. And that is such a great horror flick name. Is that a stage name?
Yes, actually, it was a name that the actor, his real given name is Lawrence Rory Guy, who had actually been in my very first film and played a sort of alcoholic father. And I always felt him to be kind of an intimidating character. And he had used that name, Angus Scrimm, as a pen name when he had written for some different publications. And when we came around to putting the credits on the movie, he decided to use that. And then... The fans just really responded to him.
I noticed your mother has some credits in your films for Phantasm, that she did some of the concept work and costume work on this tall man character.
Yeah, she sure did. It was, like I said, it was quite a family affair. And, you know, it was really the beauty of the original Phantasm is it was almost like an Andy Hardy film. It was like, let's put on a show and with friends and students and... Yeah, my mom created that finger effect that we talked about, the severed finger, and did all the wardrobe and also did some of the catering. I like to keep my family involved in the making of my films. It makes the whole affair more sane.
So what are you working on now?
Promoting Baba Hotep. This has just been so all-consuming for me to make the film and to get it out and finally get it into theaters. That I really haven't been focused on anything. Bruce Campbell and I are talking about the sequels, because if we do enough business, we think that there can be more Bubba movies. You can take Bubba and put any monster name on the back, and you got a movie. We've toying with the idea of Bubba Nosferatu, Curse of the She-Vampires, where Elvis would find himself in an old folks' home down in New Orleans, and a coven of she-vampires that he'd have to battle.
She-vampires are always good.
Yeah. The other one we're thinking about possibly is Bubba Sasquatch, which would take place up in the North Woods with a tribe of killer Bigfoots versus Elvis.
So many possibilities.
Yes.
Well, thanks very much, Don Coscarelli. It was fun talking to you.
Thanks for having me.
Don Coscarelli wrote and directed the new film Bubba Hotep. Coming up, the Danish band The Ravenettes. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. The Ravenettes are a pair of Danish musicians who've just made their major label debut with Chain Gang of Love. Where their previous CD bore the proud slogan, "Recorded in B-flat minor," the new album, says rock critic Ken Tucker, is a sonic breakthrough that extends the duo's range to include a few new keys.
Here comes the love gang. 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 Two delinquents in love. Yeah. Their love just won't stop. The pack is on the prowl.
That's the Ravenettes at their most sedate, cooing about, quote, two delinquents in love. In summoning up the phrase juvenile delinquent, this Danish twosome is suggesting a certain fondness for the late 50s and early 60s. Their album cover is designed to look like a movie poster for an unmade Roger Corman motorcycle flick, complete with a corny come-on line. This is whiplash rock and roll. But darned if that aesthetic isn't borne out quite perfectly by their new songs. The Great Love Sound, as that song is called, is a scream of ecstasy, the Ravenettes building a wall of orgasm. Chain Gang of Love was co-produced in Denmark by Richard Goddard, the American who recorded prime 70s American punk acts like Blondie and Richard Hell and the Voidoids. Working with him, the Ravenettes tap into a whole history of rock and roll of a certain sort, moody, verging on intimations of doom, pretty in an awfully intense sort of way. Take this song, Noisy Summer, which has a melody reminiscent of the Everly Brothers and production like an exploded Phil Spector extravaganza.
Chew another whip, your little dress is tight. Gonna make me burn, gonna make it right. Tell you little stories that I'll never hope that I'll end up right beside you when it comes. I'm gonna make it good, the sour, make it true. Dancing on the stairs.
The Ravenettes are guitarist Soon Rose Wagner, who wrote all the songs, and Sharon Fu. Together, their sweet and sour harmonies have a certain air of innocence, that is, until you listen to the words they're singing. These reveal the Ravenettes to follow in the grand tradition of the delinquents they revere, as they make loud, grand music about drug takers, prostitutes, and various S&M scenarios, all played for a pulp camp and a sincere intensity that are impossible to separate.
And I never think you'll get it. Tonight you're doing something. This fix is more important. Turn on when you walk inside yourself.
It's as though Buddy Holly, whose song Every Day the Raveonettes are apt to cover in concert, had secretly survived his plane crash, landed in Denmark, and decided he wanted to use his newfound freedom and anonymity to write the soundtracks to the sleaziest exploitation films he could find. As they sang on the quiet little song that began this review, "Chains, Black Leather, and Sex, It's Not That Complex." Or rather, it's as complex as you want to make it. It's just that the Raveonettes are determined to strip everything down to its essence and leave you begging for more.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Chain Gang of Love by the Raveonettes.
Let's rave on, cause I know that you want it. Let's make out, cause I know that you want it. Let's go down where the hearts are broken. Fix them all in time. Fix them all in time.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Calico Corners, your home for custom decorating, with over 100 stores across the country, on the web at calicocorners.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Dr. Drew Pinsky on treating addiction. The co-host of Loveline, the syndicated sex advice talk show, has a new book about his work at a rehab clinic. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.